Hi, it's Laura. Welcome to another episode of Future Tripping. Hookup culture is this week's topic, and we are joined by a true expert, Dr. Lisa Wade. Dr. Wade is an associate professor of sociology at Tulane University and a core faculty member in the Gender and Sexuality Studies program and an affiliate of the Newcomb Institute. She is the author of 4 books, more journal articles and book chapters than we could possibly list, and has received many prestigious awards. Her ability to research and effectively translate such incredibly important information that impacts so many is really admirable. Just a reminder that we'd love to hear from you, and if you have any questions for us, you can find us on our site at traumastewardship.com and through Instagram at Future Tripping with Laura. Welcome to another episode of Future Tripping. Today, I have the great joy of being in conversation with Dr. Lisa Wade. Dr. Wade, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So I got to be in your presence in 2017 when you were doing a book tour, when your book on hookup culture had just come out. And we came to that as a family. And I was so in awe of your work, and particularly the way you were communicating your research, disseminating your research, making your research very accessible for a number of different age groups. And I know you do so much research in sociology and gender studies and sexuality, and there's a number of places we could go with this conversation. I think because it is something that still, in my opinion, is not talked about enough, and certainly not talked about enough with the wisdom and the insight that you have, I'd really like to spend some time just initially talking about your research around hookup culture.
Okay, I'd be really happy to.
So why don't you share with us what got you interested in that? And then just walk us through what you found when you were doing that research. And then I know that book came out in 2017. You were at Occidental. Now you're at Tulane. So you're still in the college environment. So I'd also be curious to hear your thoughts on the evolution of hookup culture.
Well, I was teaching classes in sexuality, sociology of sexuality at Occidental. And I was listening to my students talk about hookup culture. I was also paying attention to what the mass media, sort of pop culture, was saying about hookup culture. And I noticed a couple things about it that really alarmed me relative to what I was hearing from my students. And one was that the student that was overwhelmingly centered in all of those stories was this hypothetical or real, nice-looking, from a, you know, economically fine family, ostensibly heterosexual white woman. So our anxiety about women and whether women specifically should be having casual sex was on full display in pop culture. Whereas my students were coming from all different backgrounds, all different religions, all different parts of the country, and they have all different racial backgrounds, sexual orientations, and there was such a more interesting story to tell than just that one story. And the other thing that I noticed was the pop culture conversation was all about a kind of should she or shouldn't she conversation. It was all about the decisions that students were making and not about the context in which they were making those decisions. And as a sociologist, that was something I could really do if I could get some students to help me, the actual culture that they were embedded in, and maybe help explain, not try to justify or not, but just help us understand the sort of constraints that the students were under.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Would you be able to talk us through some of the primary findings that you discovered when you were doing that research? I know you poured so much into that research and really were trying to be very holistic with it. And I'm wondering if you could walk us through some of the findings from that time, you know, when the book came out, and then we can move on to talking about how things have evolved.
Sure. So what I ended up doing was asking 110 first-year college students to write diaries for me over the course of a single semester. So I asked 110 of them to do this in classroom environments. And I also asked if they would donate those diaries to the book project. And 101 of them said yes. So the book is based on these 101 student diaries, all first-year students, all at two different small liberal arts schools. And the data I got was so incredible because students are brilliant and funny and lovable. And, you know, they have the most amazing stories. They're all different from the next person. And so I really felt like I was able to kind of immerse myself in what it was like to be each one of them over the course of about 12 weeks. And one thing I learned was that not all students are participating in hookup culture, and not all students who are participating really enjoy it. So only about 20% of students were participating and loving it. And they did love it, to be fair. They were having the time of their lives. About a third of students weren't participating at all. So they weren't hooking up. And because hooking up in hookup culture is also the primary avenue to get romantic relationships, they usually also weren't participating in romance at all or having sex in romantic relationships. And then there was a small percentage of students, about 5%, who were strivers, who really wanted to participate, but couldn't seem to get into hookup culture to find people to hook up with them. And then finally, the plurality of students, about 45%, they were participating, but with mixed feelings about it and mixed experiences. And so most students were, you know, feeling uncomfortable with, disappointed with, frustrated with hookup culture. Some of them were having really negative experiences. A lot of students were opting out, and only a minority were having a really good time. And when I tried to figure out why are so few students having a good time, especially when most young people are very excited about casual sex on campus?
Right.
The big thing I discovered, I think the overarching kind of umbrella problem, was that students had divided in their minds sex into two types. There was hookup sex, and then there was relationship sex. And because they had divided them, they defined them as opposites, polar opposites. So if relationship sex was sweet and benevolent and egalitarian and about mutual pleasure and discovery, hookup sex was the opposite of that. It wasn't supposed to be sweet or kind. It wasn't supposed to be benevolent. It was okay to be selfish about your own pleasure and so on and so forth. And because they divided sex this way, when they were treated unkindly, when they were deprived of pleasure, when they had sex with their peers in a hookup, they didn't define it as a problem with hookup culture. If they didn't enjoy it, they defined it as a problem with themselves. And so the big crisis I felt was the way in which the carefree, quote unquote, carefree approach to sex that the campus was, you know, the campus culture was advocating was actually quite careless. And, you know, some people can stomach that very well, but a lot of students aren't going to be able to stomach that, especially when, you know, 50% of them are virgins when they get to campus. So they're just dipping their toe into the pool. And if they really want to play, they gotta get just jump into the deep end. So, and of course, that problem, the problem that it was off script or wrong to express care for your partner, really contributed to a lot of other problems that we're familiar with, like consent. Like, if you're not supposed to care about what your partner wants, then why would you care about their consent? Like unequal pleasure, or even like, you know, being bigoted or prejudiced against certain kinds of students and being seeing them as undesirable sexual partners. If the idea is to sort of have sex with people that other people will think is a good, quote unquote, lay or catch, then you avoid people that are, you know, by American standards, considered undesirable. So that problem contributed to a lot of others as well.
Oh, so interesting, Dr. Wade. how does this get communicated? Like, how do you see this getting passed down? Where do folks learn some of these, you know, ground rules in terms of what is relationship sex? What is hookup sex?
Yeah, I love that question. So, well, first of all, I think hookup culture is, if you watch, you know, your average television show or movie about college life, you see it. It's there. It's not like it's this completely alien culture that only college students know about. They're learning about it from media before they get to college, from older students they know who've been to college, and they'll talk about, oh, my friends who had been to college told me this or that about what college life would be like. Once they get to college, there are pretty aggressive penalties for, you know, expressing warmth and friendliness toward your sexual partners and hookup culture. I often say when I give lectures that the worst thing you can be called in hookup culture isn't slut or prude. It's desperate. Nobody wants to seem like they want somebody more than that person wants them. And so they try to avoid as best they can seeming like they have any interest in their sexual partners at all. And then there are all kinds of little tricks they have for communicating to their sexual partners that they're not genuinely interested in them in any way. So that involves making sure that the sex during hookups is hot but not warm. So avoiding all of those signs of care, like prolonged eye contact or caressing or deep, slow kissing, anything that might kind of make it seem like it might be relationship-y. It's sort of off script. There is the classic example of sort of being aloof the next day. So whatever relationship you had with a person before you hooked up with them, the next day you kind of give that relationship a demotion. You kind of hold them at arm's length, at least for a little while. So being aloof. Alcohol plays a really important role here too, in that students generally define relationship sex as sober sex and hookups as drunken sex. And so making sure that one is or appears to be drunk or high is a way to kind of make it seem like what someone's doing isn't thought out or considered, and therefore who they chose to do it with isn't thought out or considered either.
Thank you so much. I want to go back to something you said earlier, because this has been something that I've seen be very confusing for young people, is when you were talking about folks who do want to actually be in a relationship and feeling like hookup culture is a portal into then getting to be in a relationship if that's what they want, and the way that that can lead to that and often undermines, backfires, definitely does not lead to that. Can you walk us through that a little bit? I want to make sure I'm understanding from your research on that.
Yeah, it's a little ironic because hooking up is the primary route into romantic relationships on college campuses, meaning that most relationships start as a hookup where both people are or are pretending to be totally uninterested in each other romantically. And so they'll hook up, and then maybe 2 weeks or next semester, they'll hook up again. And then they'll hook up again, and then they'll hook up again. And then at some point, there's a certain number of hookups where they start to break the rules. So sex starts to warm up, or they act a little more friendly after, or they, God forbid, hang out in a non-sexual setting together alone. And slowly but surely, that encounter might slide into something, and students have all kinds of baby steps that they take, but that it might eventually look like a romantic relationship. The irony is that because that's the primary route to relationship, and everybody knows that, it's even more important that students treat each other pretty callously if they don't want a relationship or don't want to appear to want a relationship. So it's actually the fact that hookups function to form relationships is part of the reason why hookups themselves are so cold.
So there's a communication, I mean, consciously or unconsciously, I imagine for some of I'm going to go to this other extreme, just FYI, not interested in a relationship. And so I'm going to be even more extreme over here in terms of, as you're saying, cold, withdrawn, not particularly interested in consent, et cetera. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's not even because people don't want relationships. Most students do, if not with everyone they're hooking up with, but most students are interested in relationships. But if being interested in a relationship with someone is the most embarrassing thing that can happen to you in hookup culture, then most everybody is at least pretending like they don't want that. And it can be a kind of downward spiral because it's a really, you know, you want to seem less interested than they are. So, and they want to seem less interested than you are. And so it can create a kind of dysfunctional outcome.
Yeah. What did you discover about when this really started taking root with young folks?
Yeah, so I date the beginnings of hookup culture on college campuses to around the mid-1990s, and here is why. So I'll tell this story as simply as I can. In the 1960s and 70s, we had the women's movement and the sexual liberation movement. And the feminists at the time, they wanted two things. One is they wanted women to have access to the spheres of life and that we sort of cast as masculine. So they wanted them to be able to play sports and become lawyers and doctors and do all of those things that men had traditionally held for themselves. Because women knew, feminists knew that that's where the power and the esteem and the money was, right? But they also wanted everyone to kind of sit up and notice that the things that women had traditionally been responsible for, you know, taking care of families, doing nursing, teaching, all of these like lovely things that women have historically done in our society, feminists wanted people to notice that those things were also valuable and that there should be, you know, esteem and power and money associated with those things too. And really what ends up happening is that feminists get the first thing, but not the second thing. So over time, since the 1950s, say, we in America have become substantially less sexist in that we think that women can do essentially everything men can do and should do those things. But we've become actually more prejudiced against femininity. So we're less prejudiced against people perceived as female, or more prejudiced against femininity. In fact, those things that feminists wanted people to value have become increasingly less valued. So those, you know, young people of the 1960s and 70s who are fighting this good fight, doing their best to win what they can, they have children, and most of them teach their daughters, you can do anything men can do. And by that, the girls know that means that you can do what boys do if you want. And that in fact, if you want to be liberated, empowered, you should do what boys do. And if you want to be kind of seen as like a badass woman, like a cool chick, you should do what boys do. And so women start applying that logic to their leisure activities, their friendships, their careers, their college majors, and to sex. And so if you think about it that way, that everybody, if they want to feel cool and liberated, should act in relation to sex the way they think a stereotypical man does, then you have a pretty good description of what hookup culture is. And those girls, those daughters get to college around the mid-1990s.
That is really helpful history. Thank you so much. Can you walk us through your experience and what you found around how we stay sex positive, how we make sure we don't get into slut shaming, and also how we're able to acknowledge where harm around hookup culture happens. That seems to me where some of the fraughtness comes in.
Yeah, well, I can kind of think two directions I can answer that. I'll say first and then I'll follow up second. I certainly want students to have what they want on college campuses. And the truth is that students as a group have every possible desire we could imagine. And I would like them to have more choice. Right now, they kind of have the option to opt into or opt out of hookup culture, and that's it. I would rather that they had the opportunity to explore all kinds of different ways of relating sexually or not. And so I think that would go a long way. I also think that we need to separate in our minds the difference between freedom and equality. And I do think that you might describe what's happening on college campuses as some kind of freedom, in that nobody's telling them no anymore. But we certainly don't have equality. And I think that if we had equality and freedom, then we could be a lot more positive about what was happening on college campuses. But I think it's a mistake to think that freedom alone is what we need to have like healthy and happy sexualities.
So building on what you're saying, what we know to be true in relationships where there's abuse and violence is this power differential. And it seems like that is also at play when we're trying to sort out sex positivity and then hookup culture and what can be helpful about hookup culture or positive. I don't want to be reductive here. And then also a lot of the harm that can come from hookup culture. So I'm wondering, I know you study this in so many different ways in your work, in your field. Can you talk with us a little bit about how that power differential comes in here?
Well, let's zero in on gender for a minute. So on a college campus, men and women alike are free to have casual sex with each other or amongst them. And so that is true. But because we have historically denigrated femininity, and we do so even more, because the worst thing you can be on a college campus is sort of desperate for a relationship, then we definitely have this notion that like a feminine approach to sexuality is less than. It's embarrassing. It's like maybe kind of cute, but definitely old fashioned. It's not cool or badass or free or liberated or empowered. Now, so if that's the one thing nobody wants to be, but we still associate it with femininity, then most people assume that women, by virtue of being somewhat feminine, are more like that than boys. So we have this culture that by definition says, here's the ideal. It is the stereotypical idea of how a male approaches sexuality. And we've agreed amongst ourselves that women are worse at it than men. So every time a woman hooks up with a man, there is this implicit impression that she is more interested in a relationship than he is, which means that by definition, women are always losing in a zero-sum game in hookup culture. Mm-hmm. Men are always winning and women are always losing unless proven otherwise. And that makes men be a little more stiff-armed than they normally might have been because they're just assuming that women want a relationship. And it makes women feel like they have to put up a stiff upper lip and really show him that she's not interested in a relationship. And so that really deepens the coldness of hookup culture, but it also always sort of positions women as the losers in this competitive game. And that, what I find, is what contributes to women's dissatisfaction with hookup culture relative to men's. It really sucks for you to be always losing unless you prove otherwise. And that's a big part of why they enjoy hookup culture less than men.
Thank you so much. And so in terms of how this plays out in queer relationships and with differing gender identities, what is your experience about what's the same and what's different?
Yeah, well, you can imagine that if there's a critical mass of students who are minoritized on a campus, right? So there's just statistically fewer of them. If there's enough of them, though, if the school is big enough, that there's enough of them, they could conceivably create an alternative hookup culture for themselves. And we do see that. So students of color, for example, who often feel excluded from the mainstream hookup culture will have a hookup culture of their own. And queer students will have hookup cultures of their own. I don't know that we know exactly all of the ways in which that manifests. I'll say at Tulane, I see two queer hookup cultures. There's one that serves men having sex with men, and then there's one who serves everybody else. And those hookup cultures, we think, both when they're students of color, queer students of color, are a little different than the mainstream hookup culture, which tends to be overwhelmingly white and ostensibly heterosexual, in that those communities are often also communities of care, where they've come together to support one another as minoritized students on a campus. And that changes the nature of the hookup culture a little bit, in that there's a lot greater cost to being cruel to one another, to being cold to one another. There's a lot more incentive to maintain relationships with people you've hooked up with. And I've found that to be true for students of color to some extent, to those queer cultures on Tulane's campus, although not necessarily in the cultures that serve men having sex with men. We also notice that students who are in these kinds of categories tend to hook up with people off campus, other students at other schools and other people in the community. So they tend to extend off campus more so than the dominant hookup culture on most campuses.
It's really helpful. One of the things I remember you sharing when you were talking about the research around this book is the long-term damaging consequences of hookup culture for many people. Not everybody, as you're saying, for many people. I'm wondering if you can walk us through that a little bit. That was something I remember being very struck by, that it wasn't just, you know, ugh, the next day feels kind of like, ugh. But for some of the folks I know you were in touch with, it was months and years.
Yeah, I want to be a little careful here. So I don't want to suggest that attending a college or university with a very vibrant hookup culture is going to do irrevocable damage to a young person. I don't think there's any evidence that that's true. I mean, of course, some people have acutely terrible and traumatic experiences, and those are serious and should be acknowledged. But the general experience of hookup culture outside of those acute traumas, I don't think there's any evidence that it makes it, for example, difficult for people to ever form a meaningful romantic relationship with someone, or averse to commitment, you know, or never want to have children, right? The psychologists I've spoken to, they say that those kinds of attachment traumas happen when you're much younger. And so spending a few years in hookup culture, setting aside any acute crises, is probably not going to create these really devastating long-term effects. That said, it does mean that young people are developing the skills to form and maintain romantic relationships a little bit later than maybe their parents and their grandparents. You know, we saw quote-unquote going steady start in the 1950s, where teenagers in high school would become boyfriend and girlfriend. That was the first time in American history that had ever happened. Adults were sort of mortified. And they called it premature monogamy when these teenagers would pair off into relationships. You know, they probably formed those skills a lot earlier than today's young people do. So they have some catching up to do compared to the kids from the 1950s. I'm not convinced that that's necessarily a bad thing. At least in history, it's not necessarily always been true that people form those skills earlier. You know, prior to the 50s, people would more or less court and then get married, and they'd have to figure it out on the fly. So
part of what I'm struck by, Dr. Wade, and tell me if I'm misunderstanding any of this, is it sounds like some of the dynamics, again, I imagine some of this is conscious, some of this might be unconscious, and the implicit and explicit messaging around this is that even if you're wanting something different or feeling a particular way, that there seems to be quite a bit of pressure to be deceptive with oneself or talk oneself into a story or kind of, I don't mean like formal dissociation, but like disconnect, disintegrate, dissociate from perhaps what one authentically, organically is wanting. And I'm wondering if I'm understanding that correctly, and if so, what you found to be the consequences of that. You know, these kids who are very quick and very smart and tracking all that's going on, and how probably it doesn't take long for them to get a sense, as you're saying, of the lay of the land. And this whole piece of having to not be authentic to oneself about what one really wants, in a sense, to be able to survive, at least those who engage in hookup culture. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, I think one of the things that was most striking to me in doing this research was the degree to which the women I talked to had really internalized the idea that to be liberated, they needed to act like they thought men acted and do what they thought men did. And so they really did come to campus thinking that if they were free women, you know, if they didn't repress themselves sexually, then they should and they could feel great having the sex that hookup culture has to offer. And they didn't always. In fact, most men didn't either, because this is based on a stereotype of what men are like, not reality. But when women didn't feel, when hooking up didn't make them feel free or feel liberated, they had a really hard time finding something to blame other than themselves. And so they often really internalized, they didn't have this like big picture, historical, cultural analysis, right? So then they internalized their feelings and assumed that there was something wrong with them. So I often heard students saying things like, I don't know why I can't feel comfortable doing it. I wish I felt comfortable doing it. I don't know what's wrong with me. I just wish I could loosen up and not be so uptight. I just heard a lot of that. And then so then they would assume that there was something wrong with them. And one of the things I really wanted to achieve with this book was to give all different kinds of students permission to feel however they felt and to know that they weren't alone in feeling what they were feeling, and to give them that sociological imagination to consider the possibility that it's the environment they're in that is somehow problematic and not themselves.
Right. What is your opinion on where self-respect plays into this? The ability to be, you know, self-preservation, to be really self-honoring, self-respectful. What does that look like in hookup culture? How does one engage in hookup culture and be both self-respecting and also, I mean, assuming well that these folks are authentically compassionate people, empathetic people, kind people, and that there's a type of role-playing that's going on?
So in hookup culture, it is against the rules to demand accountability from your partners, to demand that you are treated with respect. You might imagine that one way that someone would be self-respecting, right, would be to demand that partners treat them with respect, with kindness, with benevolence, with consideration, right? Treat them as an equal. But all those things are off script in hookup culture. So if you turned around to a sexual partner in hookup culture and said, I demand all of these things from you, they would think you'd lost your mind. And it is genuinely off script to do that. If somebody treats you badly and you don't like it, then you need a thicker skin, is basically the rule. So in the absence of that option, the way that I think students try to have self-respect is unfortunately in this kind of neoliberal way mm-hmm. that we across America are taught to engage with really uncaring environments, right? Which is to put yourself first, to make sure you get yours in a competition, to make sure you win, right? And never to like give up or give in or be too kind. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, one of the ways, maybe the only way I ever heard women really trying to wrest some self-respect out of the fact that there's unequal pleasure on campus. Women in first-time hookups have about one orgasm for every three that men are having. The only way I ever saw them come up with a solution to this problem, because they couldn't ask for orgasms from their hookup partners because that's off script, was to be as selfish about orgasm as they thought men were being. So the women would say, like, I'm going to go in there and get my orgasm and then I'm going to leave. And that was their only, the only way they could imagine trying to get equality with men was to be as ungiving as men were and as taking as men were. And I don't think, you know, if you ask any of them that that's the equality they want, but it was the only thing they could think to do to try to even the playing field.
So interesting. And I don't want to be remiss in this part. Can you walk us through, I'm realizing I didn't ask you a basic question, of the rules of hookup culture as you found them, like the do's and the don'ts. Can you walk us through those?
Well, the main rule of hookup culture is that one should be having sex with anyone who is sufficiently hot for sex itself. And that picking people because they seem nice or being interested in relationships is off script. So the idea is to have as much sex as you can with as many different people who can bring you status by virtue of your hooking up with them, meaning that they're popular, elusive, considered very attractive. That's the main rule of hookup culture. And then, of course, there's many little rules that play into exactly how people find other people, how you initiate hookups, how you pursue and complete, and then how you act afterward. There's many, many rules there as well, some of which we've talked about, like being aloof and being hot but not warm and so on.
And for young people who are wanting a relationship and not solely wanting to hook up, did you see ways that they did that that didn't start with hookup culture? I hear what you're saying, that hookup culture for so many is the primary window into that. Did you see that there were other ways that that was achievable?
Well, so that's most people, by the way. Most students on campus both want to hook up and are interested in romantic relationships. And I think to answer your question about, does anyone find a different way to end up in a relationship? I think to answer that question, I have to kind of give listeners a little bit more imagination about what hookup culture looks like. So the one I'm describing mm-hmm. is really most faithfully enacted by the most high status students on campus. So the people that really thrive in hookup culture, who hook up the most, who like it the most, who enforce its rules the most, they are disproportionately privileged on all of our axes of oppression, right? So they're white, they're heterosexual, they're wealthy, they're able-bodied, they're conventionally attractive, and so on and so forth. But there's lots of other little corners of campus that don't really intersect with that too much, right? So you can imagine, you know, your band kids who have their own social life going on that is separate from this other one that often has roots in Greek life. Or you just have like the nerds on campus that find each other, the people that like to play role-playing games and video games and go to Renaissance fairs and those kinds of kids, right? And then you have your like religious subgroups where most students on campus are not particularly religious, but the particularly religious students can find one another. And in those places, you do sometimes see alternatives. And so I think, for example, the kids who tend to be kind of nerdy and a little bit less, you know, socially smooth than your typical frat guy and sorority woman, they tend to make friends with each other. And then sex kind of comes out of friendships, and then romance can come out of friendships in a way that's not entirely different from hookup culture, but is different enough that you can kind of get romance without just throwing yourself in that deep end. And of course, religious students sometimes have the rules amongst themselves about the best way to get to know one another and enter relationships. And in those small niches, you see differences. I think that the students that are having the best sex on campus are probably those students. Sex is better when you know someone better, when you feel more comfortable, when you have sex with them more than once. And those students are disproportionately, ironically, the ones that we would think of as less conventionally sexually attractive, the nerds, the band kids, the religious students.
And did you find that there are outliers within hookup culture, that folks who are totally down to hook up, have casual sex, and also they make decisions around, actually, I still can be kind, and I still can be thoughtful, and I still can be warm. Like, did you find that there are outliers, or did you find that the culture is so strict around this and the consequences so significant if word spreads within your dorm, or like you said, within Greek life or within the sports team, that you're outside, or like you said, off script?
So I think it would be fair to say that almost every student on campus, you know, both is and isn't following the rules of hookup culture. So one of the reasons it's interesting to sort of elaborate the rules of hookup culture is to be able to observe when people break them. And most people break them when they're kind of falling for someone and they think maybe that person is falling for them too, you know, being just a little bit warm in a hookup, at a fifth hookup, you know, can encourage the other person to be a little bit warm too. And so I think most students are really actively not following the rules, but navigating them in the best way they can, given how they're feeling about the people they're hooking up with, which I think is important. And thank you for asking that question, because it is important to recognize that these students are not dupes. They are in a culture that they don't control as individuals, but they are strategic actors, and they're doing their best to get what they want, given the rules set in front of them.
So building on that, you know how back in the day, I don't know how long this goes back, but, and not that this is not very problematic, but there would be conversations about who's, you know, partner material as opposed to who you hook up with, and definitely not partner material. And all of this is putting in air quotes. Do you find that to still be present in terms of that kind of reductive categorization?
Yes and no. And this is such a rough answer, but so you're talking about the kind of old school, like good girl, bad girl dichotomy. Like there's girls a guy would have sex with, and there's girls a guy would marry, and they're not the same girls, right? They're two separate categories of women. And the quote unquote bad girls can be expected to be treated badly, and the quote unquote good girls can be expected to be treated well. I still see that dichotomy, but it is not one group versus another group. Instead, it's applied to all women over time. So let me explain. So basically, in hookup culture, men are free to treat all women badly. Everybody's a bad girl in hookup culture. And if you get treated badly, you know, and you didn't like it, well, then again, you should get thicker skin, right? So everybody's a bad girl in hookup culture until if they're hooking up with men, the guy they're hooking up with decides that he likes her. And then she gets moved into the good girl category. Now she's his girlfriend. So for example, women in relationships with men today in college are having more orgasms than any women in history. As soon as men move her out of the bad girl category and into the good girlfriend category, he treats her really, really different than he treated her before. Same woman, mm-hmm. but different treatment. So rather than being put into one category or the other, mm-hmm. women who are hooking up with men generally have to be the bad girl until and unless some guy decides to lift her up into the good girl category.
Wow. And for folks who are not trying to participate in that and who just like can't stomach that and they're trying to like be embodied when they're also having sex, how does that look for folks who are like, yeah, I'm not doing that? Do you find that folks make decisions to just no, thank you, after they've had a number of experiences that just leave them feeling a particular way? Or do you think it just some of this runs its course? I'm trying to understand the calculus a little bit more when folks are not able to come from a place that is a bit less integrated internally.
Yeah. So if you look across a 4-year college experience, the data is very clear that people are hooking up the most right when they get to campus as first-year students. And then it kind of goes down across the year. And then they hook up. There's another little spike, and then they come back for sophomore year, but it's not as high as it was before. And it dwindles out over the year. And there's another spike in junior year, but not as high as before. So there's definitely a declining interest in hookup culture over the course of a 4-year career. And in my own data, even amongst the first years, it was very clear that students were much more likely to start out enthusiastic and end up ambivalent, or start up ambivalent and end up abstainers, than the other way around. So I think a lot of students come to campus thinking, you know, woo, this is going to be amazing. It's going to be a 4-year orgy. Everybody's going to have a wonderful time. And then they have these negative experiences and realize that it's not all it was cracked up to be.
Yeah. Couple other questions for you just connected with that. So your book came out several years ago. Have you noticed, found, observed anything different in terms of how this is trending? And that can be, you know, in general, that can be, we know more now than we did before about queer relationships. This can be that we're all more fluent, hopefully, in, you know, gender non-binary. I'm wondering if you see any different trends.
You know, I don't think we have the data to answer that question. You know, I'm at a different institution now, and the hookup culture has some differences, but I don't know if it's because it's been a few years or because this school's culture is different or both. And we just don't have any large scale data that allows us to compare over time. I think, you know, given that I can't give you a data answer, if I were to try to think about where hookup culture came from and where it's going, those neoliberal trends in our society that tell us that it's okay to put yourself first, that you should put yourself first, that all of life is a competition, and that every part of life should be treated like a marketplace with winners and losers, I don't see that declining at all. You know, what we see on campus is just a microcosm of what we see in the United States. And if I was seeing real trends in America, mm-hmm. toward cooperativeness, caring, you know, valuing femininity and all the things traditionally associated with women, you know, setting aside competition, valuing selflessness, like if I was seeing those changes, mm-hmm. I would be really looking to hookup culture to see how it was manifesting there. But given that I don't see American culture on a much different trajectory, I'd be pessimistic that hookup culture was getting kinder. Rather, I would think it was going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, thank you so much. Okay, second to last question for you. Let's say lots of kids are participating in hookup culture. For some of them, they're unscathed. We're not seeing any negative impact for whatever reason. It's going well for them. Let's say with what you're sharing, there are many for whom it is really not working. It's not serving them. It's having adverse effects. It is not in any way constructive, edifying, contributing to their lives in any beneficial way. If you're a roommate, if you're a friend, if you're a sibling, if you're an aunt, parent, and you are seeing somebody you care about and you know they're participating in hookup culture, and you are seeing over time that this is really seeming to be damaging. Let's put abuse aside. I'm not talking about abuse, right? But you are seeing there being an impact that seems worrisome. Do you have any thoughts and advice on how to talk with somebody in a way that, of course, is not on any level trying to go anywhere near shame or chastise, like none of that. But just, do you have a constructive way to talk about this, both kind of the language and the approach?
Yeah, I guess I would want someone to get across three ideas. And one is that it's okay to feel the way you feel and to desire what you desire and to need what you need when it comes to sex and sexuality. Like, there is not one right way to be sexual. That is the absolute opposite of freedom. The only way to be free is to do X, right? So the first thing I'd want to get across is, like, whatever you're feeling and whatever you're needing is just what you feel and need, and that's beautiful. The second thing I would want to get across is that if there's a mismatch between what you need and feel and what you have the opportunity to experience, don't blame yourself. That there are bigger things afoot that are shaping our sexualities, and there's lots of people who feel like you do. And so trying to stay away from self-blaming, probably by pointing to a culture that doesn't take into consideration your needs and desires. And then finally, that if we are going to get what we want, if what we want isn't available in whatever sexual culture we're in, then the only way to get that is to say what we want out loud. And it's such a simple recommendation. I recognize that it's terrifying that everyone is loathed to say out loud the truth about what they want mm-hmm. in terms of sex and mm-hmm. relationships. But it's the only way to actually attract to you the people that want the same thing you want. And as long as we reframe rejection as, you know, dodging a bullet, oh, I said I wanted this and that person rejected me, you know, that's a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. Reframing that as positive. And then keeping open and transparent about your desires and wants until the right person comes along who wants the same thing.
That's really beautifully said. Thank you so much, Dr. Wade. We ask all of our guests to share with us, if they're willing, any practices they engage in that just help them sustain, particularly when things get overwhelming. I imagine with your research and with your teaching, there's so much that is life-affirming and super sunshiny and feels awesome. And then you really wade into some very challenging subject matter as well. So I'm wondering what practices you engage in, even if you can just share a couple with us. What are your non-negotiables that just help you sustain, particularly when things feel really challenging for you?
Well, I think, you know, there's something really special about being a sociologist, because what sociologists do is they look outside of the individual to find the problem. You know, that's one way of defining what we do is we look outside of the individual to find the problem. And because I have the practice of being a sociologist, because I have practiced it for so long, I think I have, it's really my instinct to always do that. And if that's the way a person thinks, then it's really easy to kind of look at humanity and just see good. Because if someone's doing something that we might see as bad, if someone seems bad, the instinct of a sociologist is to ask why, right? What's going on? What about the world is creating this outcome for this person? And so even though I study a lot of things that are really depressing, because I'm a sociologist, it's really easy to maintain a sort of love for humanity. And I think that helps a lot.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wade. Thank you for taking the time to join us today. Thank you for your incredible contributions to the field and certainly to society, both for younger people and older people alike. And thank you for being willing to have this conversation with us and share so much of your insight and knowledge and wisdom with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Laura. And thank you for this, all those beautiful, kind words. It means a lot to me. And I'm very, very pleased to have spent this time with you.
Our podcast, Future Tripping, is a Trauma Stewardship Institute production. I, Laura, am your host and producer. Our incredible executive producer and sound engineer is Olivia P. Sunier, without whom this podcast would not be possible. It's edited and mixed by Tom Stiles, with original music by Cameron DeVore. Our graphic designer is Evie Burrows-White. Thank you for downloading and subscribing, and, as always, please give us a holler with any questions or suggestions. We can be found at traumastewardship.com and on Instagram at Future Tripping with Laura. There you can find both an email and phone number where you can ask your questions of our upcoming guests. I am grateful you joined us. Please remember, however your overwhelm is feeling today, you're not alone. You're in good company, and I look forward to being with you here on Future Tripping again next week.